You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 8th of April 2016 on Monocle 24. How badly does Russia really want to sort out Nagorno-Karabakh? Why does a visiting prime minister need to take 1,000 people to China? And when should politicians yell back at the voters? I'm Andrew Muller, and this is Midori House. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. On today's show, Russia brings its peacemaking talents to bear on Nagorno-Karabakh. My guests Tim Marshall and Martin Sanbu will be here to discuss that and other stories from international diplomacy and America's campaign trail. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Tim Marshall, editor of The What and The Why and former diplomatic editor of Sky News, and Martin Sanbu, economics writer with The Financial Times. Welcome both. And we will start with the recently resurgent squabble over Nagorno-Karabakh. This is, of course, the restive but long dormant portion of Azerbaijan, largely populated by ethnic Armenians. A dreadful war was fought over it in the early 90s. This erupted again last week, leaving dozens dead before a ceasefire was declared. Tellingly, this truce was agreed in Moscow before Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov and Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev flew out to visit the opposing capitals. Tim, first of all, let's extend credit where it's due. Given that Russia is the principal supplier of weapons to both Armenia and Azerbaijan, this is quite selfless of them, isn't it? Sort of attempting to broker a ceasefire?
Beautifully put. They are the only ones with any oomph here. The Minsk group consists of Russia, USA and France, and they are the sort of contact group that should be all involved in creating peace between the different factions. But only Russia's got any say, which is why they've been front and center. Now, as to the second part of your sarcastic remark and question, yes, they are the principal supplier of arms to both countries, Armenia and Azerbaijan, but what they do not wish to happen at the moment, when they are playing the responsible statesman around the world, in Syria, for example, in Ukraine, and now here, they present themselves as the peacemakers, which indeed they are, because they do not want it to get out of hand, because if it gets out of hand, there are several thousand Russian troops based in Armenia, and although they have cordial relations with both sides, if the Turks were to decide to join in on behalf of Azerbaijan,
on whose behalf they made some remarkably bellicose statements in the last couple of weeks,
then Russia would then be compelled to join in on behalf of Armenia. And despite all the bellicose remarks between the two countries, the bigger players, Turkey and Russia, do not want to fight a war. Consequently, Russia is actually playing a very responsible role. I mean, it's not always entirely cynical. They don't want a war between these two, and they are calming it down as they do periodically. It's just at this time it got closer to being another all-out war like in 94 than it has done for the past 20 years, and so the alarm bells rang and Moscow got involved.
Martin, how dangerous is Nagorno-Karabakh? Tim there just made reference to the war in the 1990s, which was largely overlooked, partly because of where it was and partly because the world was struggling to understand an even worse war in Yugoslavia at the same time. But it was hideous, Nagorno-Karabakh. 30,000 dead at least, nearly a million displaced on both sides. What are the possibilities of something similar occurring again?
You're right. It was quite hideous, and especially when you take into account that this is a fairly small place, so those numbers are even bigger if you compare to the size of the population. But I'd rather sort of sadly suggest that what's most relevant to us looking from the outside is not so much, unfortunately, the plight of the people of Nagorno-Karabakh or the surrounding region. And that might not be the main part of Russia's involvement either. So just think a little bit more broadly about the region. This is the South Caucasus. It's an energy-rich region. It's a region close to other places from the former Soviet Union where Russia has had interest. Georgia is right to the north.
Well, Nagorno-Karabakh in particular is very close to those pipelines which go from Azerbaijan through Georgia to Turkey.
And there's a Western interest in an escape route for energy resources that doesn't cross Russian territory. So there's a lot of sort of grand political considerations here. And what we might just be seeing is Russia's quite understandable tendency to take an opportunity to project itself in the neighborhood and show that it matters, and its decisions will matter for whatever happens to the region.
I mean, Tim, is it possible or is it sensible, I guess, to compare Nagorno-Karabakh to various other so-called frozen conflicts that Russia has instituted or fostered or nurtured, you know, Abkhazia, South Ossetia, Ukraine, Transnistria? Is it of a piece or is it a standalone proposition?
Sorry to say, it's both. I'll explain. Each of those examples you have given is different in its complexities, as I'm sure you are aware, and each are done for different reasons. Where it does come together is, yes, it is of a piece in that Russia is the senior player, and therefore you have to go to Moscow when you want things solved. And that is what Mr. Putin's last 15 years partly has been all about, Russia back as one of the main players in the world. And I would argue he's succeeded. I mean, this is a mini statelet of, I think it's about 180,000 people. I mean, it really is a tiny little conflict. And yet, because of the pipelines that you've mentioned, it does have the capacity to become a very big regional problem. I don't think it's going to, because although, I mean, the West sees this as a route of getting energy through the Caspian and therefore freezing Russia out. So you could even argue it would be in Russia's interest to blow the conflict up, to blow that route out of the water. It just doesn't want to do that because it's playing a bigger game at the moment, which is the big statesman of the world. Very briefly, because I know Nagorno-Karabakh, people in newsrooms roll their eyes, and so nobody ever explains it. Basically, this Nagorno-Karabakh was left inside Azerbaijan when it was a Soviet republic, despite it being a predominantly Armenian Christian enclave. When you get the Soviet Union breaking up, those people are left inside Azerbaijan, which is predominantly Muslim, and they want to be part of Armenia, hence the war. And ever since then, it has threatened the regional peace.
I mean, Martin, it is, as Tim suggests, a headache at a number of levels. There is conflict which is geographical, which is nationalist, which is ethnic, which is religious. Is it actually, even with the best will in the world on both sides, which I'm sure doesn't actually exist, is it practically solvable?
Well, I think the experience of other conflicts is that these sorts of long-standing ethnic tensions tend to get resolved as generations pass and new generations come along that don't have actual fighting in living memory. But I wanted to just echo what we just heard about how these frozen conflicts actually are probably play right into the hand of Russian interests. I mean, Russia is a diminished power compared to the Soviet heyday. But it's quite useful to be able to be a sort of veto power. If you have frozen conflicts around you where you are a player, nothing can ever get done unless you agree to it. That sort of veto power is a sort of pretty good aim for the kind of diminished status that Russia currently has. You see it in Ukraine, you see it in Syria and so on.
There is a peace plan, and there has been for many years. Like there is for them all, you know, Israel-Palestine. If you want, I'll solve it over the next 60 seconds because I know how to. This one, the peace plan, is that Armenia returns all bits of Azerbaijan, which Azerbaijan says it has seized. In return, Azerbaijan gives cast-iron categorical guarantees for the rights of the Armenians in Nagorno-Karabakh and even in some sort of very loosely autonomous federation state. And all the 700,000, was it, Azeri refugees who fled?
It was a lot.
Yeah, a lot. But anyone who wants to go back to regions from which they thought they had to fled can do. That is the peace deal. They're nowhere near it.
The phrase easier said than done understates the matter wildly. Let's move along now. Let's take a look now at Australia, my homeland, of which Malcolm Turnbull has now been Prime Minister for just over 6 months, which measured against recent turnover makes him something of a veteran. He has, however, spent much of his term thus far looking like someone who devoted rather more time and energy to plotting how he'd get the job rather than what he'd do once he got it. But he has now announced something bold, a visit to Beijing, a company by 1,000 or so of his closest friends in the Australian business community. Martin, the obvious headline here is the size of that delegation, which is extraordinary. That is several plane loads. Is this just theatre, or is there a practical purpose to taking this? This is almost a measurable percentage of Australia's population he's taking with him.
And an even larger percentage of its business people. I think there is a serious and practical good reason to do this. The turn to China has been going on for some time, of course. Turnbull's predecessor, but one, Kevin Rudd, who was very much speaks Chinese and so on. You know, Australia is already, as you probably know better than me, kind of starting to make this mental shift from being in the Anglosphere to being an Asian economy. Makes perfect sense when you see the growth of China. What's happened recently, of course, is a change in how the Chinese economy is actually growing. So until recently, its main function for Australia has been as a commodities importer. Iron ore, coal, all of these things that Australia has made a lot of money from. Now, that's not where the future of China lies, so that's not where the future of Australia lies. Of course, there'll still be all of that. But I suspect that what we're seeing, I hope that what we're seeing, is a realization that if all goes well with Chinese economic development, it's going to monetize its economy, it'll be less of this manufacturing powerhouse taking in iron ore from Australia and churning out manufacturing goods for the rest of the world, and be one that produces more for its own country, more of a service-based economy. And in that case, there are many, many other services and things that that Australia may want to trade or exchange with China. So the size of this delegation suggests to me that we're going beyond a commodities exports relationship with China and a more sophisticated, diversified relationship. And that can only be a good thing.
Tim, there is a minor diplomatic headache in the background here, which was that Malcolm Turnbull recently described Chinese manoeuvring in the South China Sea as counterproductive. I guess there's always two questions, which is one, how badly will that actually have gone over in Beijing, and how badly will Beijing pretend it went over?
Well, it did go down badly, and they're not pretending, but at the same time, each side in this is pragmatic for exactly the reasons that Martin's just laid out. You see, it's not contradictory to have an economic policy, which we've just laid out, which is extremely important to both sides, probably more to Australia, and simultaneously have a foreign military policy, which does not fit it. For example, the Australians are now allowing more than 2,000 US Marines to base themselves at the very tip of Australia as close as they can get to China, which has not pleased the Chinese. Australia fully backs the American policy of sailing close to these new man-made islands, which China says is sovereign territory, but in international law is not necessarily sovereign territory. Australia backs this. But I don't see that that is contradictory. I mean, it's not like they're at war or close to war or a Cold War or in sanctions. You know, you can have your foreign military policy there, and you make your statements and you say back off and we're keeping an eye on you and all the other things. And simultaneously, you can have a trading relationship. And in fact, it's the trading relationship that means that your finger prodding militarily hopefully doesn't go beyond that, because you've both got things to lose. So you can see how it's complementary almost and not contradictory.
But just to follow that up though, Tim, in terms of the diplomatic aspect of the relationship, aside from the economic ones, because obviously Australia does have fairly considerable economic clout. It's a wealthy country, yeah, and it has a lot of natural resources. But in terms of the actual diplomacy of things like this, Australia likes to think of itself as a big player on that front, but looked at from China's point of view, this is a country with a population slightly smaller than Greater Shanghai.
Yeah.
How much does China really care what Australia thinks?
It does, because it fits part of a bigger pattern, doesn't it? If this small population size nation across the sea is allowing 2,000 American Marines, which will also bring with it a naval presence, which is the bigger picture of part of what's going on in the South China Sea, you have to take notice of Australia. It's part of a much bigger picture. If every single time somebody prods you in the chest, you take a step back, let's say Australia takes a step back, all the other people in the neighbourhood realise, oh, they're not standing up and America's not standing up. So every single time Australia backs the United States, when the United States prods China in the chest by sailing close to its island, the whole neighbourhood sits up and takes notice. Ah, they're not backing down. So what I'm saying is that, yes, Australia is a country of 18 million, I think.
Bit, no, 20 and 20. A bit. 20 it's, and change
it's
now,
growing,
I think.
Right. Yeah. Which, compared to China, is nothing, but it fits a part of a greater regional pattern. And at the moment, they've got a lot to cooperate about, and there's also got a lot to argue about. And as I said, it is not contradictory. If they ever came to blows, then that would be contradictory, and at which point it would fall apart.
We need to see this in the context of the kind of great power rivalry that's going on across the Pacific, and it isn't just military. So the US and Australia and a number of other Pacific Rim nations have just signed the Trans-Pacific Partnership. China has been excluded from that or not been invited to come along and feels quite strongly about that, sees it as a way to exclude it, encircle it, and so on. That's probably not quite the idea. The idea is to sort of set standards that China will then have to gradually comply with to join. And I think in due course, probably there will be some sort of way China can be incorporated to that trading area. But I think that shows why it is important for China to continue developing trading relations, commercial relations, diplomatic relations, and continue to better that with all the neighbors, including, well, all of them are smaller than China, because otherwise their default is to go to the US.
Okay, well, we're going to look now at the US and its campaign trail, and whatever misgivings one may possess about the establishment of political dynasties, the Hillary Clinton campaign does at least offer the compensation of Bill Clinton campaigning, at which he remains exceptionally good. At a town hall meeting in Philadelphia yesterday, he was confronted by hecklers disputing the legacy of his crime reforms on black communities. What followed was that depressingly rare spectacle, an actual debate between a politician and voters. Let's hear what Bill had to say.
Whoa, 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 whoa. No, wait, wait. I want to deal with them all. Come on. No. Come on. Wait, 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 wait. Wait. See these other signs? This is what's the matter. I don't know how you would characterize the gang leaders who got 13-year-old kids hopped up on crack and sent them out onto the street to murder other African-American children. Maybe you thought they were good citizens. She didn't. She didn't. You are defending the people who kill the lives you say matter. Tell the truth. And the reason is they know it's true is they won't hush. When somebody won't hush and listen to you, that ain't democracy. They're afraid of the truth. Don't you be afraid of the truth.
Bill Clinton in rare form there. Tim, I am very much in the camp of people who think that politicians don't yell at the voters nearly often enough. We did have this absurd election campaign in Britain last year at which politicians were kept as far away from the public as they reasonably could be. Why have they become so scared of the public? Because when you stand up and have the row...
It's your fault. It's the media.
But when you do stand up and have the row, it almost always looks good for the politician.
Okay, on the first point, I honestly think it is partially the media's fault for going after them in a certain way and sometimes blowing things out of proportion and sometimes taking things out of context because it makes a good story. And they have learnt to run scared of the 24-hour news cycle. And they know if they come into contact with members of the public, the members of the public are not constrained and will speak their mind, and they don't want to look embarrassed. And so they have hidden from us. But I agree with your second point, that when they actually say, well, hang on a minute, this is what I believe, this is what I stand for, let me come back to you, they look good. And Clinton, I listened to the whole 11 minutes, he looks really, really good. I'm not talking about the rights and wrongs of what he said. That's the third bit of this argument. The only meaning to this story is the one you've extrapolated, and that is about media and politicians and the modern world. The only other one is, will Bernie Sanders join in on this? The background to it is that Black Lives Matter are challenging the Clinton legacy. One of the banners there said, Clinton crime bill destroyed our communities, meaning that the 1994 crime bill that he brought in with Hillary supporting him, they say, destroyed black communities. But most black American voters do not buy that argument. And so I don't actually think that the substance of the debate between him and the people that were shouting after him is actually going to affect the US election campaign in any way unless Sanders makes an issue of it.
Martin, yeah, do you think heckler technique is... Are there some politicians who just can't do it, though? Are there politicians who have the natural advantages of being a great speaker, like Bill Clinton obviously is?
I was waxing nostalgic. I think most politicians don't know how to do it, whether this was sort of a masterclass, right? One, it was rhetorically wonderful, and it was improvised, right? I mean, Obama is a great orator, but it's all planned. This was all off the cuff. Second, you can tell how Clinton has convictions for all his personality flaws and disappointments in his presidency.
He always had a prison one.
That's right. And third, I think this does exactly map into the Sanders and Hillary Clinton rivalry. I mean, I think the kind of function of this protest is precisely an attack on Hillary Clinton's campaign from the left. And I think it's very impressive how Bill Clinton improvise, off the cuff, managed to turn this back at them. He's saying, if you're a progressive liberal, if you think that Black Lives Matter, you should agree with what Hillary and I did. So there aren't many people like that, and you kind of wish for more.
Well, there is always the Ronald Reagan approach.
There are cities in Michigan. There are cities in Michigan. Oh, shut up.
We're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Monocle has bureau around the world. In Tokyo, Hong Kong, Singapore, Istanbul, London, Toronto, and New York City. In Singapore, our bureau chief is Nolan Giles.
I think for Monocle, the news that we're after isn't your ordinary what's big on Channel News Asia kind of news. It's the stories that are a little bit harder to find, the stories that you have to dig a little bit deeper. And the way that the team operates here from the Singapore Bureau is we're often dispatched to different countries in the region, to different cities, to travel, to explore, to meet people, to be on the ground and be in the action and build a strong contact base.
Hear from Monocle's editors and correspondents on the stories that matter and the places that matter every day on Monocle 24.
This is Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. It's time now to cross to Murano and Monocle's editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé, who is going to tell us a bit about what's coming up next weekend at Monocle's annual Quality of Life Conference, this year being held in Vienna. I'm also joined by Monocle's editor, Andrew Tuck. Tyler, can you hear us?
I can hear you indeed.
Excellent.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Excellent. A week to go before things kick off in Vienna. What can people who have not as yet booked their tickets look forward to?
Well, they can look forward to really a whole weekend. I mean, this time next week, I imagine that Andrew will probably be chilling down a couple of bottles of sect at this point. Literally this time next week, Andrew, if I'm not mistaken, that'd be Andrew Tuck. We will just be preparing to meet about 170 delegates from around the world, 25 speakers who are going to be assembled for the conference, and we'll be having a bit of a cocktail party for them.
Yes, hopefully we'll be in nice polished shoes and a good jacket by then. I think there's going to be a bit of rehearsal in the afternoon as we kind of make sure that everything is in place. We've got 25 speakers coming in from all around the world, you know, an amazing lineup of people coming from everywhere, from Israel to Detroit, coming from Estonia, all sorts of places, to talk about everything from urbanism, architecture, communications. It's a really kind of great day on the Saturday where we have a good lineup of panels, you know, feisty, fast, good debate that really will leave people informed about, you know, their businesses and their lives in the years ahead.
I mean, Tyler, that international scope of panelists that Andrew mentioned does, of course, bring a huge variety of perspectives to bear. In the time that we've been doing these conferences and doing Monocle's Quality of Life survey, have you noticed that there are radically differing views around the world of what quality of life is, or do you think there are fairly universal ideas of it?
I think that's one of the great things about the conference is that you set out your stall with quality of life, and it brings in such a diverse mixture of people. Of course, you'll have property developers, Andrew, have one view about how they want cities to evolve. You will have policymakers who see it a completely different way. And then you have, you know, people who are, you know, literally working, you know, in a 9-to-5 environment. They might be in the service sector. They might be in retail. They might be in government, and they have a different view. But I think what's interesting is I think people all buy into a narrative, which we're saying that, you know, we are trying to create a series of experiences that make from that moment that you go to sleep until you get up and everything that happens in between to be superior. But of course, you know, in between all of that, there's a lot of room for discussion and debate, and that's what makes it a very lively day from when we kick off at 9 right until, of course, we wrap up around 6 o'clock in the evening on the Saturday.
And Andrew, as you know, no tree is safe near us. We'll also be launching a couple of books while we're actually in Vienna. We've produced a new guide to Vienna that's coming out next week. We just walked out Paris this week as well. But we're also launching a new big weighty tome, which is How to Build a Nation, a new guide from Monocle, you know, 350 pages. That looks at everything from how you design a parliament to how you build, you know, a sense of kind of social cohesion, how you run an education system, to even how you design your passport. And that will be the final panel of the day. So there's a chance for anybody who's attending to get the special edition signed.
Tyler, we should talk a bit more about the book. Is that, I guess, are we now in the business of producing manuals for how to develop a quality of life for an entire country?
It seems like it's come to that. It was never engineered or designed, and I think as Andrew and I have discussed it, is this what happens after 10 years of doing a magazine, putting out 10 issues a year, that suddenly you realize that you have a volumes of thoughts and images, you know, which are, of course, inspiring and challenging. And I think that's, you know, that's in many ways a part of the book, but also there's, you know, a lot of fresh elements in the mix as well. But part of it too is just, I would say, Andrew, you know, if you think, and that's Andrew Tuck, if you think it's fair, you probably, we've also had more people from the world of diplomacy, governments at a civic to a state level, I think also coming for, I would say, informal discussions about how we, of course, measure things, what do our metrics look like. And I think that's, you know, maybe a little bit, which also propelled the book slightly.
Yeah, and certainly when you see even the people coming to the conference, there are many people who I see their email addresses give away the fact that they're in the diplomatic service, they're working for central government, they're sitting in foreign ministries. And I think Tyler's right, that what's happened over the time is, you know, that we've argued about many small fixes to nations, and it's built up into a kind of big picture about how you do things, how you do things better. And I think also this idea that you tend to get these days that every country is kind of flat and kind of the same, and, you know, if they've got a Wi-Fi system and they've got a bit of investment in technology and a couple of industries, everything's hunky-dory. We're kind of saying, actually, not everywhere is the same. Let's look at best practice around the world. You know, who is leading the way, for example, in healthcare or education? Who is leading the way in soft power? Who's even leading the way in senses of defence? And we're really talking about countries here who need to protect themselves. It's a changing environment, whether that's from terrorism or some grumpy neighbours. So we've looked at really some of the kind of more contentious issues that we've been, you know, focusing on over 10 years now.
And just a final thought following that up, Tyler. One of the sessions I know at the Quality of Life Conference is about the future of communication in a world that is being, I guess, made more homogenous by communication. Is the idea now, do you think, I guess, and as espoused in the How to Build a Nation book, that nations still need to work harder to find a way to celebrate what makes them individual?
Yeah, that's one part of it. And I think at the same time as well that we want also, you know, a truly, you know, plural, you know, very diverse, I think, you know, set of views about also how do you transmit information, how do you receive it. It's not going to be one way. And I think that's also, you know, a key point that we want to bring up, not just in that session, but hopefully across the board. And of course, everyone can tune in, speaking of good broadcasting, next Saturday, because we're broadcasting live across the day.
I should just point, Andrew, we have a very busy week next week. We have a whole team going to Salone, to the Milan Furniture Fair. They'll be broadcasting live across Monocle 24 next week. We're doing a great series of shows with Nike. Listen out for those as well. And then we'll be going seamlessly onto Vienna for the conference there. book launches. So it's a big week for Monocle.
We will have to leave it there. Tyler Brulé and Andrew Tuck and our previous guests, Tim Marshall and Martin Sanbu, thank you all very much for joining us. That is all for today's show. It was produced by Tom Hall, research by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Charlie Young and Maria Granina. Our studio manager was Antonio Fernandez. It's more music next at 1900. Marcus Hippie is in with The Menu. The Daily follows at 2200. I'm also your host for that. Midori House returns on Monday at 1800 London time for this edition. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend.